wide-eyed. "It's so big." "Oh," said Aylin, "you mean my red magestone?" Mary brought both hands round to tickle Aylin's ribs with her fingers until he could capture the offending digits and bring them up to his lips to be kissed. She let out a low moan and freed her fingers, pulling Aylin's head down so she could kiss him. The results were more than satisfactory, and their faces were bathed in pulsing red and blue glows from three magestones.
"I seem to be ahead of you," said Aylin, after they broke their kiss. "Let me help you catch up."
He removed Mary's jacket and shirt. Her new magestone and setting rested between her small, firm breasts.
"My eyes are up here," said Mary. "I was looking at your setting," said Aylin. "Sure you were," said Mary, squeezing his hand. "What's it made from?" he asked. "Electrum." "Exactly," said Mary. "An alloy of gold and silver. Maybe you are looking at my setting."
"They're very beautiful," said Aylin.
"My maidstone and setting?"
"Those two," Aylin teased. Mary's voice grew serious.
"We have a problem," she said.
"We do?" asked Aylin.
"Yes,"
said Mary, her eyes changing to look as merry as her name. "We're both wearing too many clothes."
"Hmm,"
said Mary, cuddled naked against Aylin's body under a thick quilt.
"That was lovely. Do you think you can sleep now?"
"There was never any question of me being able to sleep, dear lady," said Aylin.
"It's just that now I'll fall asleep with a smile on my face."
"Me too," said Mary. "Not only am I in your arms, but today I learned my brother is still alive."
"Tell me about him," said Aylin.
"Tell me all about your day, for that matter." Mary leaned up on one elbow and told Aylin about her travels to Ryas with Damon and their stop in Melencarrig.
"That was you I saw in the window," said Aylin. "You waved to me."
"No, I didn't," said Mary. "If I'd seen you, I would have tried to find you."
"It doesn't matter," said Aylin. "We're together now."
"Yes, we are," said Mary. She kissed two of her fingers and transferred the kiss to Aylin's lips.
"Knowing your brother Saldar is alive helps me understand why Derry didn't object to you learning wizardry."
"What do you mean?" asked Mary.
"As far as you knew, you were his sole heir," said Aylin. "I know you said nobody cares about wizards inheriting noble titles out in the Borderlands, but that never made sense to me. Wizards can't rule."
"You're probably right," said Mary. "I was so interested in learning from Dothan, I convinced myself it wasn't a problem."
"You don't mind not inheriting Applegarth and your father's lands?"
"No," said Mary. "Especially not if my brother is still alive and can return once he's finished his work in Ryas. Learning wizardry is far more rewarding."
"Good," said Aylin. "I wanted to make sure you were comfortable with not succeeding your father."
"I think my father understood me better than I knew myself," said Mary. "He saw how I was fascinated by Dothan's magic whenever we stopped at his tower on the way to Typhoid."
"Your father is a wise man," said Aylin.
"I wonder..." His voice trailed off, and his hands moved, sliding along her body under the quilt.
"What do you wonder?"
asked Mary, beginning to react to his touch. "What it would be like to have wizards for parents?"
"That is an interesting question," said Mary, "and one I'm glad we won't have to face firsthand until we both remove our fertility control charms."
"I didn't mean that," said Aylin. Mary moved her body closer to Aylin's as his hand reached the centre of her back and pressed before shifting down her spine in small circular motions.
"What did you mean?" asked Mary.
"I was thinking about Nerd," said Aylin.
"Nerd?" teased Mary.
Her own hands reached out for Aylin.
"Not me."
"In addition to you, dear lady.
Nerd's mother is a wizard."
"Right," said Mary. "He doesn't get along well with Furcher."
"And vice versa, from what I can tell," said Aylin. "But I was remembering something Nerd said in the common room."
"About you single-handedly intimidating the Befalanders into calling off their attack on Brendinas?"
"No," said Aylin. "About us coming up with a few surprises of our own."
"Like what?" asked Mary. Aylin's hands were rubbing her lower back and she was breathing faster.
"Like going back to Melencarrig to set one up."
"Hmm?" asked Mary. Aylin whispered in her ear.
Really? She said. Do you think it could work?
I do, said Einan. We'd need help from Furcher and Dothan, and Nud, too, for that matter, plus a few more wizards.
Dothan can ask Intira, said Merry, and maybe Astri could assist.
Astri? The old queen's private wizard. Wears blue robes so dark they're almost black.
Sure, said Einan.
We can leave that part up to Dothan. Should we go down and tell them?
In a few minutes, said Merry.
She pushed Einan on his back and straddled his hips. Merry's palms were on his shoulders, and the weight of her upper body held them in place. The two of them sank deeper into the feather bed.
You're not going anywhere right now, she said, smiling down at Einan. I've got plans for you.
Chapter 41 Letitia and Quintilius. Letitia stared into the hoop that had been a ring on her finger moments ago. The sun was 2 fingers above the western horizon, the time she'd scheduled to contact her husband.
I've got an update for you, dear, she said.
Is it anything serious, my love? Asked Quintilius from his tent, with the legions and the contingent of Roma wizards on the eastern shore of the Brenavon.
Just this small matter of barbarians from the northern clanlands raiding down the Abernoth Valley, said Letitia.
The purple beads in her dark braided hair clicked as she turned her head to accept a message from a servant.
And every ship in Tamloch is sailing down the coast toward Nova Eboracum.
I see, said Quintilius. That sounds like quite an inconvenience. Do you need me to return?
Not immediately, said Letitia. How much longer do you expect to be in the south?
My scouts inform me that we're likely to have a decisive battle in the morning. I'll return as soon as we win.
I love your confidence, darling, said Letitia. Come home to me safely.
With my shield or on it? Said Quintilius.
See that it's with your shield, dear. State funerals are expensive and depressing.
I love you too, sweetheart. Try to hold the barbarians north of the Long Lake.
I'm more worried about the fleet from Tamloch than the barbarians, said Letitia. Especially if our ships are transporting troops up the river.
I have some ideas about how to supplement our navy, said Quintilius. I'll keep you informed.
See that you do, dear, said Letitia. The right information is worth a legion.
Or two, said Quintilius. How are the children?
Terrorizing the nurses, as usual, said Letitia. Primus did ask me when you'd be emperor this morning, though.
I hope you cautioned him about that sort of talk when others could hear him.
I did, said Letitia. He's only 7, but I think he understands. He told me he wants to command your Praetorians.
I'll encourage him to aim higher, said Quintilius. A consulship at least.
At least, Letitia repeated affectionately. I'll ring you with a status report in the morning.
Thank you, my love. And see what your sources can learn about the bright light in the sky a few hours ago. It looked like one of Mafuta's fireballs, but 10 times as large and 100 times as bright.
Curious, said Letitia. I'll look into it.
Salve, said Quintilius.
And you, my love, said Letitia. Be well.
She ended their connection and collapsed her hoop down to a ring, slipping it on her finger. Back with the legions in the south, Quintilius summoned a servant, a girl of 9 or 10 in a loose purple chiton, and sandals laced up to her knees.
How may I serve you, Governor General? She asked.
Please find Mafuta and Felix, and ask them to come to my tent at their earliest convenience.
Yes, Uncle,
said the girl.
She opened the tent flap and ran off in search of the 2 wizards. Quintilius didn't have the heart to stop her and insist that his sister's youngest daughter follow proper military protocol. He'd have a quiet talk with her once they were back in Nova Eboracum. A few minutes later, the wizards entered. Quintilius offered them high stools and took a low stool for himself, so their eyes would be close to the same height. He chuckled to himself when he realized that Felix had gone through a growth spurt and was nearly as tall as he was.
"Do you think you could get a private message from me to King Bejani and Queen Sidney?" asked the provincial governor.
"I don't see why not," said Mafuta. "Flying scouts have located the Byferland fleet. They're less than 12 miles away."
"How do you propose to deliver the message?" asked Quintilius.
"Like this,"
said Felix. The tall, thin young mage in flowing purple robes rotated his hands in front of him like a potter working clay on a wheel. A construct of solidified sound began to form, and soon a simulacrum of a golden dragon with outstretched wings hovered before him. Quintilius smiled, and Mafuta extended her right arm and gave her colleague a thumbs up.
"Do you have a message?" asked Felix.
"I will in a moment," said Quintilius.
He found a pen and parchment and dashed off three quick lines, then folded the parchment.
"Mafuta?" he asked.
The older wizard picked up a stick of sealing wax from the Governor-General's camp desk and channeled heat from her purple mage stone into its substance until a blob of wax sealed the message. Quintilius pressed his ring of office into the hot wax, then waved the parchment back and forth to help it cool. When the wax solidified, he handed the message to Felix.
"Can you spare a ring pair?" Quintilius asked Mafuta. "That would speed up our negotiations."
"I have a pair in my tent," said Mafuta. "I'll give one ring to Felix and deliver one to you."
"Excellent," said Quintilius. "How long will it take you to get to the Byfarland flagship?"
"Less than an hour," said the tall young wizard.
"Before nightfall, then?"
"Well before," said Felix.
"Off with you, then," said Quintilius. "Safe flying."
Mafuta and Felix stood and gave small bows.
"Governor General," they said in unison, then took their leave.
Quintilius leaned over a map spread out on a table beside his camp desk. In the morning, his legions would march south along the course of the Brenhaven until they were opposite a large island in the middle of the river. They would wait there until they got word from Furcha and Dothan, and would do what they could to avoid engaging the Bifalanders. Part of Quintilius was curious how his legionnaires would fare against the Northerners. Roma's legions had the discipline to take on any foe, and the Bifalanders were only one step removed from the chaotic fighting styles of the northern and southern clanland barbarians.
"With fortune's favour," thought Quintilius, "it won't come to that."
"May I enter?"
asked Mafuta from the entrance to the Governor-General's tent. Her right hand was closed.
"Come in, please, Mafuta," said Quintilius. "Is Felix on his way?"
"He is, Quinn. You can count on him to deliver your message," said Mafuta. "Here's your ring," she said, extending her closed fist.
Quintilius opened his palm and Mafuta dropped a small gold band into it. The Governor-General slid the ring on his little finger.
"Now we wait," said Quintilius.
"Now we wait," said Mafuta.
"Care for a game of shamat to pass the time?"
"Set up the board," said Quintilius, "and don't expect me to go easy on you."
"Ha," said Mafuta, "I've won our last four contests."
"Don't remind me," said Quintilius. "Let's just hope I win the one that counts."
"Oh,"
said Mafuta,
"what did you write in your message?"
Quintilius told her. Mafuta held her sides and laughed loud enough for a guard to stick her head inside the tent and be dismissed.
"Queen, queen, queen," said
Mafuta between bouts of laughter,
"you are in so much trouble. If you don't win, Letitia will kill you."
Chapter 42. Daemon and Dario. Daemon and Dario were flying north toward the Daran army's camp. The young king had his arms around the old wizard's waist and was reveling in the view of the countryside below from Daemon's flying disc. The counties south of Bendinus along the river were largely agricultural, filled with large estates and dotted with small towns and freeholders' farms. In the waning light, Dario could see ploughed fields with their dark soil beginning to turn green as early shoots emerged from the ground. Castles occupied several natural and human or wizard-made high points in the area's topography. The royal army was encamped west of the main road leading from Brendinus to the southern reaches of the kingdom. Troops, organized by feudal units, had set up tents on a field belonging to the Earl of Cladach. A well lined with blue-veined granite in the center of the encampment provided fresh water.
"The stones were probably dug from the quarry near the dormant dragon," Dario supposed.
Daemon descended toward a collection of marquees and pavilions decorated with pennants and heraldic banners. Even at sunset, Dario could read them as easily as he could a book. He knew at a glance which of his nobles were at the army's headquarters. Duke Haydn's banner, a dark blue rose on a white field, was particularly prominent. A horizontal blue sword was painted above the rose. It marked the Duke as the kingdom's Earl Marshal and commander of the royal army. Dario heard shouts from men and women at arms as they landed. "The king! The king! Dario is here!" He could sense a buzz of reports radiate out across the camp. "Rumours travel faster than wizards," thought Dario. He smiled when he realized he was riding behind the infamous author of that epigram. Duke Haydn stepped out of a large rectangular marquee, flying dark and light blue pennants, to greet the young king and master mage. The Duke was in his early 40s, the same age Dario's late father would have been. He was of average height, but had long auburn hair that made him look like an older but still powerful lion. His physique reflected 4 decades of intense martial training, and he wore a coat of blued mail over a white padded gambeson.
"Your Majesty," said the Duke, extending his hand.
Dario shook it and introduced Damon. The Duke bowed to Damon and shook his hand as well.
"We've met, Master Mage," said Duke Haydn. "I was with Crown Prince Daroth when you froze the Abernoth. I'm glad you've returned to help Daran in our present generation's hour of need."
"Yes, yes," said Damon. "Glad to assist and all that. Let's go inside."
The old wizard paused and stared at the Duke for a moment.
"Has anyone ever told you that you resemble your father?"
Duke Haydn laughed, and so did Dario.
"What?"
asked Damon. "There's a famous fresco of the Duke's father on the wall of the Great Hall in his castle," said the young king. "He's been hearing that comparison for decades."
"Is there?" asked Damon. "I wasn't going by a fresco. I knew his father personally, and remember him when he was a young man not much older than you are now, Dario. I hope Haydn has inherited more than his looks from his father."
"My esteemed sire taught me many things," said the Duke. "I hope I live up to his memory."
"You'd better," said Damon, "or things won't go well in the morning."
The 3 men, each representing a different generation, walked toward the entrance to the headquarters tent.
"Do you think I could get a mug of cider?" asked Damon. "I've got a lot of news to share, and talking is thirsty work."
"There's a standing order for a cask of Applegarth cider in the headquarters tent," said Dario.
"In that case, make it 2 mugs, said Damon.
They stepped inside as guards were lighting torches on either side of the tent's entrance. Damon was on his 2nd mug of cider, while the king and duke were still sipping their 1st. The master mage had established a sphere of solidified sound to prevent them from being overheard, and had just finished updating the Earl Marshal with assistance from Dario. They were standing next to a sand table, where their current location and the land on both sides of the river for 5 miles had been sketched. Small, blue-painted rectangular wooden blocks, marked as infantry, cavalry and archers, representing the forces of Daran's royal army, were already in place on the expected site of the upcoming battle.
"See if I understand our tactical position correctly," said Duke Haydn.
"We're here."
He pointed to the royal army's location. Damon and Dario nodded.
"There are 500 ships filled with bloodthirsty Bifferland warriors who may or may not decide to attack us here."
The Duke indicated several yellow blocks positioned in the river. Damon shrugged and opened his arms to confirm. Dario shook his head slowly from side to side.
"The main strength of Tamlok's army is just north of us," the Duke continued, placing green rectangles exceeding the number for Daran's army immediately across a broad open stretch of sand.
Dario rolled his hands in a "yes, yes, get on with it" gesture. Duke Haydn reached out a finger to touch a collection of purple rectangles to the east.
"And our only allies are on the far side of the river, with the nearest bridge more than 20 miles upstream at the capital."
"That sums it up nicely," said Dario.
"Except for the point about Vero having an extra surprise to spring on us," noted Damon. "We're not sure what that is."
"Oh, joy," said Haydn.
His face looked anything but joyful as he finished his mug of cider. He frowned when he realized he couldn't get a refill until Damon dispelled the privacy sphere. The old wizard tipped an inch of Applegarth cider from his 2nd mug into the Duke's.
"What's your assessment of the situation?" asked Dario.
"It doesn't look good," said the Duke. "The royal armies of the 2 kingdoms are evenly matched. We've been trained to fight each other, and our wizards know the attacks and counters of their opposite numbers in Tamlok. The odds are good we'd end up with a stalemate, but we have to defeat them decisively, because they're between us and Brindinus."
"And city walls don't count for much against wizards," said Dario. "Not that anything in Brendinus beside Darren Castle is equipped to stand a siege."
Correct, said Haydn. And the Bifferland fleet is still a wild card. Plus that surprise you mentioned, which I expect won't be good for us.
A wise assumption, said Damon.
So why are the two of you looking more worried?
Remember what Damon did a generation ago to help Darren's army? Asked Dario.
He froze the Abernoth, said the Duke.
Oh.
And the Brenavon isn't as wide as Abernoth. The legions will be able to support us and flank Tamlock's army. This could be entertaining.
That's not my preferred choice of words, said Damon.
Sorry, said Haydn. I meant it ironically.
I know, said Damon. I'm anxious about Vero and his surprise, but I have a surprise of my own to spring on him.
Einan? Asked Dario.
Precisely, said Damon. That young man has more raw power than any other wizard I've trained.
He's got a red magestone, said Dario. He exploded a fireball above the Bifferland fleet that convinced them they didn't want to sack Brendinas.
That was a wizard's fireball? Asked Haydn. We saw it from here. I thought it was a comet.
No, it was a fireball, said Damon. My apprentice made it.
I'm impressed, said Haydn. And I'm glad this Einan lad is on our side. We'll take all the help we can get, and we'll probably need it.
A red mage stone, you say? Like a ruby the size of a hen's egg, said Damon.
Have you told Einan that he's going to be a surprise for Tamlock? Asked Dario.
No, said Damon. He's innocent and enthusiastic. I don't want him to worry, or get a swelled head.
That makes sense, said Dario. You can tell him when he and Mary get here in the morning.
Mary? Asked the Duke.
She's the daughter of, began Damon.
Saldwyn, one of your comrades-in-arms at the gates of Nobarabarakum, said Haydn.
Now I remember. He's Baron of the Upper Rothro now. He goes by Derry these days, said Damon. His daughter is only 15, but shouldn't be underestimated.
She sounds like her father, said Haydn.
The Duke stretched and covered his mouth to hide a yawn.
It'll probably be best if we call it a night, said Haydn. I'll update the commanders so they'll know what to do in the morning.
Don't tell them what Damon is planning, said Dario.
I won't, said Haydn. But I will make sure they know Master Mage Elderman is here to help us to victory.
That will do a lot to boost morale, said Dario.
They'll also be glad to hear you are with the army, said the Duke. Your armour and weapons and several changes of clothes are in your tent, Your Majesty. The Master of Stables has your war horse groomed and ready.
Dario looked carefully at the Duke.
His tone had been teasing and his eyes were dancing. Haydn had a surprise planned for his king, and Dario hoped he'd enjoy it.
"Where's Inthira?" asked Damon.
"I need to give her an update so she can inform the rest of the conclave in the morning."
"Cancel the privacy sphere, and I'll have the servants escort you and His Majesty where you want to go," said Haydn.
Damon gestured to dispel the sphere. Then he yawned.
Haydn called for two attendants.
"Don't stay up late," said Haydn. "You've got a lot to do tomorrow."
"I do indeed," said Damon. He sighed and followed a servant out of the brightly lit tent. The second servant led Dario in a different direction, to a large oval tent with a dark and light blue dagged trim. A dozen torches in front of it illuminated the royal standard, a light blue banner bearing a dark blue dragon with its right front foot raised below a gold crown. Dario sighed. He was tired, and the battle in the morning might decide the fate of the kingdom. He pushed open the tent flap and entered. The lighting was soft and low, just a few oil lamps, but it was enough for him to make out the location of the bed. Dario stumbled toward it. Then he realized it was already occupied.
"I'm glad you finally made it, Your Majesty," said Jennet with a smile. "I've been waiting for you."
Her uncovered shoulders peeked out above a heavy quilt.
"How did you get here?" asked Dario.
"On the back of a flying disc, with a wizard who'd showed up late for the meeting of the conclave," she said. "I thought it would be a good idea if I wasn't where Princess Gwynnett could question me further."
"Well, that makes sense," said Dario. "You're as wise as you are beautiful."
"Thank you," said Jennet. "It's checkmate in three moves."
"I know," said Dario. "I concede. You win."
He tipped an imaginary chess piece.
"You might be able to win at something tonight," said Jennet.
Oh? Do tell.
Of course, my king. My father suggested I might divert your attention with another sort of game to help you relax and sleep well before battle.
Of course he did, said Daria. That sounds exactly like something your father, the Kingdom Earl Marshal, would tell you.
Dario leaned down and kissed her gently. I may be putting words in his mouth, said Janet.
She sat up, smiled at Dario, and let the quilt slide down a few more inches.
It was mostly my idea.
Chapter 43 To Athal and Gwynedd. A single dim lamp burned inside the royal tent.
Irsa, a wizard Vero had assigned to the king, created a privacy sphere and took her leave. The dark-haired young woman had no interest in being anywhere near the king when her services weren't required.
You seem to have lost something, said King Cuathal to the image of Princess Gwynedd, inside the hoop of an expanded communications ring. I thought you told me you had Dario under control.
I do, said Gwynedd. I've just misplaced him temporarily.
Misplaced your son and the ruler of Darren? Asked Tuathal. That's sloppy and careless.
I thought he was occupied playing Sharmat and bedding would-be queen candidates, said Gwynedd. But he's gone, and I can't find him or his favourite bedmate.
I can reassure you he's safe, said King Tuathal. I've just received reports he's with Darren's royal army and camped on the west bank of the Brynavon. I can't say about the bedmate.
I don't care about his bedmate, said Gwynedd. Her eyes flashed and her voice grew hard. I care about Dario's defiance.
Tuathal shook his head.
I thought you had your son under your thumb.
Our son, spat out Gwynedd. When I get to him, he'll be much more compliant, at least after his next meal.
Nothing to harm his mind permanently, said Tuathal. He is, as you say, my son. Some day it will be his turn to rule Tamloch and Darren. We can't live forever.
I promise I won't damage him, said Gwynedd. I'll just make him more amenable to my suggestions.
Be careful, said Tuathal. I think I know the drugs you plan to use. They have side effects.
Like making 18-year-old men even more interested in horizontal entertainments than they are under normal circumstances?
One corner of Tuathal's mouth turned up. Gwynedd frowned.
I thought Dario was eating the special meals I prepared for him, she said. Reports from his servants indicated the side effects were clearly present.
Or perhaps he was behaving like a normal 18-year-old man, and you took his willingness to do what you asked as a sign of his suggestibility.
Tuathal began to laugh, then closed his mouth.
Dario is devious, then, he said. What else should we expect from my son? And yours, for that matter.
True, said Gwynedd.
She squared her shoulders.
I'll take a courier boat downriver immediately. I should be there to see to Dario's breakfast before dawn. Tell your observers along the river to let me pass.
I don't think that's a good idea, said Tuathal.
Going downriver?
No, said Tuathal. Joining Dario. The royal army of Darren's encampment may be overrun during the battle, and I wouldn't want you to get hurt.
Oh, said Princess Gwynedd. Her eyebrows rose. I didn't know you cared.
I don't, said Tuathal. At least not in that way, as you well know. Don't flatter yourself.
Gwynedd frowned again. For a moment, she allowed her mask to slip and her eyes to show her internal fury. Then her mask returned.
What do you think I should do then? She asked.
Follow your original plan and head south on the river, said King Tuathal. But allow my soldiers to intercept your courier boat and take you hostage. We can use that status as a bargaining chip with Dario to make it easy to explain Darren's surrender and my proposed solution joining our kingdoms.
Gwynedd nodded.
That might work,
she shrugged. Unless the boy decides he's glad to be rid of me and thanks you for removing me from his life.
I don't see that happening, said Tuathal. For all that he's our son, Dario is soft-hearted and an idealist. He won't want you to be executed.
Executed? Asked Gwynedd.
A threat must be credible to be a threat.
said Tuathal.
"Not exiled to a tower on the Isle of Vines?"
asked Gwynedd. "I might start with that as a threat, then escalate as necessary," said Tuathal. "We'll see how soft-hearted the lad truly is."
"I blame his great-grandmother," said Gwynedd. "She filled his head with stories
and encouraged him to read," said Tuathal. "I know. My resources in the palace in Brendina send me regular reports."
Gwynedd nodded in acknowledgement.
Of course Tuathal had spies. Everyone had spies.
"Too much reading isn't good for a king," said Tuathal. "It can give them ideas."
Gwynedd laughed, and her face contorted into what might have been a grin on someone less self-centred. "Present company accepted, of course," she said.
"Of course," said Tuathal. "Queen Garris is another crowned head who's done too much reading."
"That was never a problem for Prince Dari," said Gwynedd.
"Ha," said Tuathal. "Your late husband had no interest in reading. He only cared about three things: fighting, hunting, and drinking."
"There was a fourth thing," said Gwynedd.
"Oh, really?" asked Tuathal.
"At least until I started dragging his drinks when he couldn't give me an heir after 2 years of trying."
"I see," said Tuathal, nodding. "We really are a well-matched couple."
Tuathal smiled to himself. He'd never tell Gwynedd that the ring of friendship he'd given Dari at the feast in honour of their mutual victory before the gates of Nova Eberacum was actually a fertility prevention charm.
"Except for the fact that you prefer men."
"Except for that," said Tuathal.
"So kind of you to make an exception for me," said Gwynedd.
Tuathal gave Gwynedd a slight bow. Gwynedd grimaced.
"What?" said Tuathal. "Was my exceptional performance a problem?"
"Don't flatter yourself either," said Gwynedd. "Your performance was adequate. And Daria was the result, so I'm more than satisfied."
"As am I," said Tuathal.
"I've just been thinking about how long Queen Caris has been a thorn in my side. When will the old woman get on with it and die? I'll never be queen so long as she lives."
"You'll be my queen," said Tuathal. "That's our mutual agreement. Soon you will be the old queen of our United Kingdoms."
"I could do without the adjective," said Gwynedd.
"Too late for that, my dear," said Tuathal. "You should have poisoned the old king instead of your husband."
"But I didn't poison Dari," protested Gwynedd. "A blood clot moved from his knee to his lungs."
"Of course it did," said Tuathal.
The true manner of Dari's death was something else he'd never tell Gwynedd. He hadn't even told Vero. Gwynedd's face clouded. She knew she was being mocked. Tuathal distracted her with a new question.
"What do you know about the old queen's personal wizard? My sources haven't been able to learn much about her."
"Astri?" asked Gwynedd.
"She's another pain in my Astri," said Tuathal, considering the name. "Is she skilled?"
"She knows how to detect adulterated food and drink, at any rate," said Gwynedd.
"You haven't been able to poison or control Queen Caris because of her and resent it."
"That's one way of putting it," said Gwynedd. "My spies haven't learned anything more about her than yours have, I expect. She just appeared more than 2 decades ago, like she'd stepped out of the mist."
"I don't like surprises," said Tuathal. "And I don't like not knowing who she is or why Queen Caris trusts her."
"A sentiment we share," said Gwynedd.
"I'll just have to be content with the surprises Vero has planned for the Royal Army of Darren in the morning," said Tuathal.
Gwynedd nodded. "And I'd best get started downriver," she said. "Tell your observers I'll have blue lamps set fore and aft on my courier boat."
"I'll pass the word," said Tuathal. "It shouldn't take you more than 4 hours to get here. That will be well before dawn."
"Perhaps I can make you breakfast in the morning," said Gwynedd.
"I think not," said Tuathal, ending the connection.
Chapter 44 Quintilius.
"King Bojani agrees, Governor-General," said Felix, "but he has stipulations of his own."
"Such as?" asked Quintilius.
He was pacing back and forth along the map table in his command tent.
Mafuta stood beside Felix as the younger wizard shared his report. Her glowing light spell made the tent much brighter than the lamps on the table.
The contest must be held on his flagship.
I can live with that, said Quintilius.
And you can bring no more than 5 guards and 3 wizards.
Tell him I'll only need 2 wizards.
Quinn nodded at Felix and Mafuta. Mafuta inclined her head, confirming she'd come along to visit the Bifalanders. She knew she'd have her own part to play if, no, when, Quintilius won. The Governor-General consulted his guard captain.
I need 5 guards to travel with me to the Bifalander fleet, said Quintilius. Get me 2 of your tallest, plus 2 warriors from the Little People and Dina in full kit.
Tonight? Asked the guard captain.
Immediately, said the Governor-General. The fate of the province may depend on it. Get moving.
Yes, Governor-General.
The guard captain sprinted out of the command tent to find Dina and the others Quintilius had requested. Quintilius turned his attention back to Felix. Mafuta laughed.
You're bringing the small warriors to signal your disdain? She asked.
Not at all, said Quintilius. I want to shatter their expectations that everyone in Ocadence province is tall and carries gladius, pilum, and scutum.
That explains the small warriors, said Mafuta.
What about Dina? She's in love with the legends of the women warriors and the old Attican stories, said Quintilius. Her kit is impressive, and so is her physique. Bifalander women like a good fight every bit as much as their men. I want them to see Dina, so they'll know we Roma feel the same way.
And it's hard to tell women from men in the legions because everyone is in armor, contributed Felix. Dina stands out.
She certainly does, said Mafuta, remembering Dina's exaggerated, anatomically correct bronze breastplate. What form of competition did King Bajani select? He asked. Shamat? Archery? Single combat with sword and shield?
No, Governor-General, said Felix. None of those.
What then?
Tell him, said Mafuta. It's not wise to annoy a provincial governor.
Very well, said Felix.
He took a deep breath and struggled to replace his grin with a stoic expression worthy of Marcus Aurelius. When he succeeded, he spoke.
King Bajani wants to arm wrestle, Governor-General.
Quintilius began to laugh. So did Mafuta. Soon, Felix joined in. The 3 of them laughed for more than a minute before the chortles faded to guffaws and then to near-silent chuckles.
He wants to arm-wrestle me, to determine whether or not he and his fleet will help me defend Ocadence province?
I believe so, said Felix. He's reputed to be quite good at it.
Arm-wrestling is more a game for soldiers working off their aggression than for rulers settling the merits of their proposals, said Quintilius.
He stretched his shoulders and flexed his biceps without realizing he was doing so. Mafuta smiled.
King Bajani thinks to put you at a disadvantage, Quinn.
She raised an eyebrow, praising him. The Bifalander's monarch may be underestimating you.
What makes you think that, Futa? Asked Quintilius.
Mafuta didn't answer him, and questioned Felix instead.
Were you able to see King Bajani when you delivered your message? She asked.
Yes, said Felix.
I constructed far-seeing lenses, even though I kept my distance when my solidified sound golden dragon landed before the king and queen's thrones.
Excellent, said Mafuta.
What did he look like?
The king, asked Felix. He was solid, an old warrior, with massive arms, probably from axework. He wore lots of gold rings from elbow to shoulder on both sides.
Old? Asked Quintilius.
Close to 40, I think, said Felix.
Mafuta and Quintilius flashed each other quick smiles. Mafuta's student was not yet 20, and everyone over 30 must seem old to him.
He must be positively ancient, said Mafuta. Perhaps he won't be strong enough to defeat Quinn.
King Bajani seemed strong to me, said Felix. His arms were larger than my thighs.
But that's not saying much, Mafuta teased.
Felix was quite skinny and self-conscious about it. He shrugged.
True enough, said Felix, but I had the sense he could snap me in half like a twig if he'd wanted to.
So King Bajani is strong for an old man, said Mafuta,
but that's not the most important question.
"Which is?" asked Quintilius.
"Is he tall?" responded the older wizard.
"Oh," said Felix, "maybe." The others regarded him, waiting for more.
"He's not as tall as I am. Probably close to 6 feet, if I remember correctly."
"And you're what, 6 and a half? Asked Quintilius, narrowing his eyes and taking the young wizard's measure.
6 foot 6 and a quarter, said Felix with a grin.
"But who's counting?" said Mafuta. "You may even have a bit more growing to do."
"I'd like that," said Felix.
"Why does it matter how tall King Vejani is?" asked Quintilius. "Especially if his upper arms are massive."
"Because of you, Quinn," said Mafuta. "You're very tall." "You must be over 7 feet," said Felix.
7 foot 1, said Quintilius. "How is that relevant?"
"Arm length correlates to height," said Mafuta. "Your forearms will be quite a bit longer than King Vejani's."
"So?" asked Quinn.
"That may give you the advantage," said Mafuta. "And you're strong, at least for an old man."
Quinn wagged a finger at Mafuta, and she grinned at him. They'd been through enough campaigns together for this sort of banter to be commonplace.
"All right," said Quintilius. "I'm strong, but King Bajani's probably stronger. How does having longer forearms give me an advantage?"
"Simple, Imperial Governor General, sir," said Mafuta. "Leverage."
Chapter 45. Einan's Idea. Einan tapped tentatively on the door to the room just beyond his. He'd heard Dothan's footsteps outside his own earlier, and then the squeak of the neighbouring door.
"Dothan?" he asked softly. "Are you awake?"
"That's not how it's done," said Mary, easing him to one side. She pounded on the door with the bottom of her fist.
"Dothan, wake up! There's a hungry dragon at the gate!"
"What?"
came Dothan's groggy voice through the thick wood.
A dragon? Where?"
"Get up," said Mary. "Einan has an idea." Dothan cracked the door and peered out.
"From what I hear, Einan always has ideas," he complained.
"Right," said Mary. "But this is a particularly good one, and we need your help. Get dressed and meet us in the common room."
"Fine,"
said Dothan, sounding both more perturbed and less asleep. "I'll be down in 10 minutes.
"Make it 5, said Mary.
"Humph,"
said Dothan. He closed the door.
"Let's see if Nud and Furcher are still downstairs," said Mary.
"That wasn't very nice," said Einan.
"We don't have time to waste being nice," said Mary.
"My mother says there's always time to be nice," replied Einan. "Your mother never had to fight a battle to save the kingdom," said Mary. She took Einan's hand and dragged him toward the stairs.
"Come on!"
Einan stood fast, and Mary jerked back when she realized he wasn't moving.
"What?"
she asked.
"You don't have to be obnoxious to get things done. Is that how your father leads his barony?"
No, said Mary. "He convinces people to do what's necessary. He doesn't yell at them."
"I thought so," said Einan.
"Leaders in the Coombe know how to be effective and nice, too, or we don't let them lead."
"Maybe I should spend some time in the Coombe when all this is over," mused Mary.
"It wouldn't be a bad idea," said Einan. It was dark in the hallway. Einan invoked a light spell.
"Lakar!"
He used his free hand to wave the glowing sphere to follow them.
"I think I hear their voices," said Mary.
"Walk softly," said Einan.
"I am walking softly," said Mary,
in her normal speaking volume. "Oops," she said. They turned the corner into the common room, with Einan bumping into Mary's back.
"I thought the two of you were otherwise occupied," said Furcher.
Nud, pacing near Furcher, stopped moving and grinned at Einan.
"This must be really important for you to stop what you were doing."
"We were, it is," said Mary. "Dothan's coming down soon. When he's here, Einan will explain his idea. We'll need your help to pull it off."
"I'd be glad for the distraction," said Nud.
"What have the two of you been talking about?" asked Einan.
"This and that," said Furcher. "Family stuff," said Nud.
"Fine, don't tell us," said Mary. "Furcher,
What do you need to construct a wide gate, like the one you used to get the Roma legions here faster?
2 rectangles coated in powdered mage stones, one on either side of the gate, said Fircher, plus wizards at either end to invoke the congruency and keep it stable.
Can you get sacks of powdered mage stones in Melin Carrick? Asked Mary.
Daemon would know if any are kept on hand, said Nude.
Don't worry about it, said Einan. I know where to find plenty of tiny mage stones we can crush.
Near the mud pots and the spring of many colours?
Asked Nude. Uh-huh, said Einan. I didn't know what I was seeing when I went there to find my mage stone, but now that I know how to recognise mage stones, I remember seeing blue and green and yellow sparkling grains around several of the hot springs.
You can gather them up, said Mary. I expect Stothan and Fircher will know where to find more at the headquarters for the Conclave for this side of the gate.
Why do you want to construct a new wide gate? Asked Dothan from the foot of the stairs. He'd put on his wizard's robes, but his hair was still tousled, at least what was left of it.
Einan will explain everything, said Mary.
She waved to Nerd and Dothan.
Sit down, I'll get you some cider.
She moved behind the bar and started filling 5 mugs.
Please be ready to enclose us in a privacy sphere when I'm back, said Mary.
If I must, said Fircher.
Mary saw Einan give her a stern look from the kitchen.
I'd really appreciate it, Fircher. Thank you so much, she said.
Einan smiled. It would be a good idea to keep this private, he said. We don't want word getting back to Tamlok. It would ruin the surprise.
Could you see if the cook has any more of that chicken and egg pie left? Asked Dothan. If I'm going to be awake, I could use a snack.
I'll see, said Mary.
I can help, said Einan. He stepped into the kitchen and searched for a pie safe. He found it and removed half of one of the savoury pies and 3/4 of a loaf of dark bread that seemed fresh enough to have been baked that morning. Chi swung down from the rafters and jumped from the bar to the pass-through to the kitchen. Einan snagged one of last year's apples from a bowl on the counter and tossed it to the raconette. He promised himself he'd find a way to thank the cook and innkeeper for their hospitality and remembered the small ball of solid gold in his pouch. It's too much for a few meals and night's lodging, thought Einan. Maybe I can collect some gold dust for them if I have time when I'm in Melin Carrick, or bring them some flathorn antlers. They'd look impressive over the fireplace and bring in business. I'll have to ask Nud if they shed.
Einan, dear, are you coming?
Asked Mary. Her tone didn't match her endearment.
Is there any pie? Asked Dothan.
Just a moment, said Einan.
He caught Mary's eye.
Thanks for your help getting food for us, Mary added,
shrugging her shoulders and smiling. Einan smiled back. He picked up plates, a sharp knife and a crock of butter, not from Flying Frog Farms, he realised, and brought everything to the table. Mary had already served the mugs of cider.
Fircher?
Asked Mary. Seconds later, a privacy sphere surrounded them, and things beyond it were difficult to see. Chi had joined the gathering just before the sphere snapped into place. He was eyeing the chicken and egg pie, and Einan wagged the knife in Chi's direction.
"This is people food, Chi," said Einan. "Enjoy your apple."
Chi made a face at Einan and sprawled in the middle of the table, staring at the pie.
"Who wants pie and who wants bread?" asked Einan. "Here," said Mary.
She took the knife and deftly cut the half pie into 5 wedges and sliced off the same number of slices of the dark bread.
"Doesn't anyone else have a sense of urgency?" she asked. "Take whatever you'd like, friends. Einan, tell Nud and Fircher and Dothan your plan."
Einan understood Mary's concern and gave her the benefit of the doubt. Sometimes you had to push to get things done, and Mary was doing the pushing. Einan gave Mary a brief hug, sat up straight and explained.
"Nud gave them the idea," said Einan. "He said we should have some sort of surprise of our own to counter Vero's."
The others nodded.
"I'd love to turn the tables on Vero," said Fircher.
"I'd like to know how I can help," said Dothan.
"I'd like to save soldiers' and wizards' lives," said Nude. "If we can end this war before anyone gets hurt, I'm all for it."
"Tell them the details, please," said Mary.
Einan did. The other wizards' expressions were encouraging. Dothan was stroking his chin.
"I'll handle the gate at this end," he said.
"That would be great," said Einan.
You should be able to find wizards to help you. At the Royal Army's encampment to the north, I know, said Dothan, after I returned to the Conclave's headquarters for powdered magestones.
Virtue will build the gate in Melin Carrick, said Merry. I'll help her.
She put her arm around Einan and gave him a hug. You and Nud can collect magestones to powder near the hot springs and mud pots, then round up the remaining component of our surprise with Rocky.
That should work, said Fircher.
She faced Nud, a few seats down across from her.
Does the old man keep rope in the castle?
There should be plenty, said Nud. It's something that's always useful. I remember ordering more in our last shipment of supplies from Brendinas.
Great, said Merry.
How do we get Rocky back to Melin Carrig quickly? Asked Einan. It would take too long to fly to the Blue Spiral Tower.
Don't be ridiculous, said Fircher.
Then she stopped herself from insulting Einan further.
That's right. You don't know. There's a large gate in the rear of the Dormant Dragon. I made it years ago. It connects to the storeroom next to the kitchen. We can use that to get to another inn back in the capital, then take the gate used to transport supplies to Melin Carrig from there. It's just two jumps.
Let's go, said Merry. We've only got a few hours, and it's harder to work in the dark. Wake up Rocky and bring him to the doors to the supply room, she ordered Einan. You help him, she told Nud.
I hear and obey,
Nud replied with a smile.
Right away, said Einan. I hope Rocky cooperates.
I'm sure he will, said Nud. He's a good boy.
I'll go upstairs and collect my things, said Dothan. Fircher can contact me.
Einan may need to contact you too, said Merry. Take your ring back for now so he can reach you.
Fine, said Dothan. He took the ring from Merry, then stood up and tilted his head toward Fircher. She cancelled the privacy sphere, and the older wizard headed toward the stairs. A few minutes later, Nud, Fircher, Merry, Einan, Chi, and Rocky, under protest, went through the large gate in the inn's storeroom. Rocky's complaints, when he had to tuck in his wings and cross the gate's interface, made Dothan smile a floor above. When Dothan came downstairs, the innkeeper, her wife the cook, and their two children were in the common room.
"Your wyvern's loud," said one of the children.
"Will he be coming back?" asked the other. "I want to ride him."
"He will," said Dothan. "And I'm sure you can get a ride on Rocky's back. It's the least we can do for your hospitality."
"Speaking of that," said the innkeeper.
She smiled at Dothan and quoted a sum for the rooms and meals. "I'll be back with payment for you soon," said Dothan. "First, I have to go to Brendinas to find powdered magestone. Then I have to help save the kingdom."
"Powdered magestone?" asked the cook.
Her hair looked almost as tousled as Dothan's.
"Why would you need to go to Brendinas for powdered magestones, when we have a whole quarry full of the stuff just west of here?"
Dothan smacked the heel of his palm against the centre of his forehead. "Blast me for a fool," he said. "If I light our path, can you show me the way?"
"We'd be glad to," said the cook and the innkeeper simultaneously. "Can I have a piggyback ride?" said one of the children to Dothan.
"No, me," said the other.
"How would you like to ride on a flying disc instead?" asked Dothan.
Can we, mothers?"
asked the children in pleading high-pitched voices.
"So long as you do everything the wizard says," said the innkeeper. "And don't go too high," said the cook.
"I'll take good care of them and stay just 2 feet off the ground," said Dothan. "Let's go."
Chapter 46. Quintilius and Bajani. The borrowed boat, holding Quintilius, Mafuta, Felix and the five guards, was nearly silent as it moved downriver toward the Bifalander's fleet. Felix, who had grown up with boats on the north shore of Insula Longa, the huge fish-shaped island that stretched over 100 miles from Nova Eboracum to the coast of Tamloch, guided the Poolstone. Behind him was the guard captain, who was nearly as tall as Quintilius, and a second guard of equal height. Quintilius knew the guard captain would select himself. That was to be expected, as was the other guard the captain had selected. They were both excellent in individual combat, as well as the tight formations that had made Roma's legions feared in the lands of the west and across the ocean. The two tall guards were inspecting the edges of their swords in the light from the glowing sphere floating above Mafuta, who was seated with the Governor-General in the middle of the boat.
"You missed a spot, lad," said the guard captain, pointing out a small scratch in the other guard's blade.
"Yes, sir," said the second guard.
He applied his whetstone to the offending scratch until it was gone. Quintilius smiled at Mafuta, and the middle-aged wizard frowned at him. Quintilius was a provincial governor now, not a legionnaire. There was a certain dignitas to be maintained, which would always be a struggle for Quinn. She knew he wanted to jump into the guard's conversation, but decided against it after her silent admonishment. Mafuta could hear the two little people, the Parvi, talking quietly in their own language behind her. They were a married couple, and Mafuta recognized enough words to know they were trying to determine their odds of escaping the Bifalanda's flagship alive. She wished she was confident enough of the outcome of tonight's adventure to reassure them, and herself. Dina stood on the thwart across the rear of the boat, practicing with her longsword and round shield. Her anatomically correct, or perhaps exaggerated, breastplate was only painted to look like bronze. It was good steel underneath. Mafuta admired the younger woman, and understood her armor as an excellent tactic to distract her opponents. There was no arguing with the martial skills she demonstrated with each practice attack and block. Mafuta looked south along the length of the Brenhaven. The older wizard didn't need to create distance night-seeing lenses to make out the Bifaland flagship. It was lit with 3 dozen torches and easy to spot, anchored in the center of the river, with hundreds of other torch-lit dragon ships stretched out behind it. She made the glowing ball above her head brighter. They weren't trying to sneak up on the Bifalanders. This was a prearranged meeting.
"Bring us around to their starboard side," Quintilius instructed Felix. "They've dropped a net we can climb to get on board."
Quinn turned to Mafuta, who carried more than a few extra pounds under her purple robes.
"Climbing a net won't be a problem for you, Futa, will it?"
She tapped the flying disc strapped between her shoulders.
"No problem at all, Quinn."
The Governor-General laughed.
"Of course," he said. "I'm a fool. I hope I retain more of my wits when I negotiate with King Bajani."
"So do I," said Mafuta. Both of them laughed to break the tension. Bifaland warriors, not in armor, were waiting at the bottom of the netting to assist the visitors in ascending. None of the Roma needed their assistance, however. The Parvi climbed the net as fast and sure as squirrels up a tree, with their long-tubed weapons strapped across their backs. The two tall warriors didn't have as far to go to reach the deck, and made it up the nets with ease, carrying their full kits, including their 6-foot-high scutums. Dina decided to show off, and swung herself up the knitted ropes using only her hands, not her feet. She winked at the two Bifaland warriors there to assist, and did a handstand on the ship's railing, before landing on her feet on the deck. Quintilius, with some coaching from Mafuta, ascended with 1 foot on each wizard's flying disc. He stood tall as the discs rose several feet above the railing, before descending to land near the mainmast. King Bajani and Queen Signy stepped forward to meet Quintilius. No handshakes were exchanged, but 3 small nods were given, followed by 3 slight smiles.
"I'm pleased you decided to keep our bargain," said King Bajani, "though I've always wanted to test my soldier's skills against your legions."
"You'll have to settle for testing your skill against mine," said Quintilius.
Felix had been correct. He was 1 foot taller than Bajani, and his forearms were much longer as well.
"May the better man win," said Mafuta.
"And the better realm," responded Queen Signy.
She turned to Quintilius.
"Does your lady wife know of your wager?" "I've kept her apprised of the situation," said Quintilius.
Signy touched her husband's arm.
"That means Letitia doesn't know."
"What of that is your concern?" asked Quintilius, frowning.
"I just want to ensure you live long enough to hold up your end of the bargain," said Queen Signy.
Mafuta chuckled and answered,
"Letitia may threaten to kill him if he loses, Your Majesty, but I doubt she'll carry out her threat."
"Are we talking about the same Letitia?" asked Queen Signy. "That's not her reputation."
"I assure you, she has a deep affection for her husband," said Mafuta. "She wouldn't kill him."
"Wouldn't kill him lightly," said Signy. "I've read books on imperial history."
"And I've read accounts of your sagas, good queen," said Mafuta. "Both our peoples aren't strangers to familial violence."
"True," said King Bajani. "Quintilius has a reputation as a man of his word, or else I wouldn't have accepted his offer. It's a simple enough deal. A certain piece of land wagered against support from our fleet.
though sometimes I wonder it might not be wiser to let Tamlock defeat you and strike a bargain with them instead.
They'd never offer you what I've proposed, said Quintilius. It's excellent farmland, close to the sea.